Class, let me ask again if there are any questions. Yes. Yes. That's the claim, yes. A very interesting exercise is to linearize everything on the board around some solution and show that you have really the massless spin 2 degrees of freedom propagating on the background of that solution. So, for example, if you set a cosmological constant equal to zero, you can show that Minkowski spacetime is a solution, and you can expand around that solution and recover the two massless spin 2 modes and show that they have the correct equations of motion. Those are the degrees of freedom of gravitational radiation. Yes, per point, or alternatively per momentum mode. If you do it in terms of the standard variables, the counting is that you have, so the standard canonical variables are you have three metric, there's degrees of freedom, and its conjugate momentum is pi. Well, you always, you if you want to carefully count degrees of freedom. So let's go, but just since you raised it, let's go through the counting. There are six of these and six of these, which are 12. There are minus four constraints for 4 degrees of diffeomorphisms and invariance, minus four gauge fixing conditions, which is eight, and 12 minus eight is 2 plus 2. So it's the same counting. And you can indeed go through, it's not that painful, but it's some work to go through and reproduce the degrees of freedom for gravitational radiation. When you talk about the tensor and the vector, you're talking about the other 4 degrees of freedom. I'm sorry, the vector and the scalar, you're talking about the other 4 degrees of freedom in here, but they're gauged. They're not really propagating degrees of freedom. Okay. Sean raised a question of what if you, rather than taking this action, f wedge f times the inverse of phi, what if instead you just took the action which had phi and rather than its inverse, and you still constrained the trace of phi, say to be zero or to be a cosmological constant, then you have a different theory. Its equations of motion are just f wedge f minus the trace free part is zero. And Sean raised the question of what theory that is. Is that a consistent theory? And let me raise that as a question for the class. That's a good exercise. And it's a kind of thing where if you meditate on it, and you think about the things that we've discussed and are going to discuss, it will just snap into your mind at one point what the right answer to that. So let me leave that as a kind of exercise. So what theory is that? No, it's different because varying this, you get the equations of motion here, which have the phi inverse. So it really is different. It's a different theory. And it happens to be an interesting theory. It's not general relativity. It's an interesting theory. And let me just leave it as an exercise. It's another diffeomorphism invariant gauge theory. Okay. So, whoops. We know what prime that is. Okay. What I wanted to do was talk a little bit about solutions and then go to the quantum theory. So let me notice, so I think I want a board right here. Ouch, that really hurts. Back. That is a bad thing. Okay. Trying to get that. It's late. Okay. I talked before when I wrote down the equations of motion of the theory with the V in it. I mentioned there were solutions where, as space-time objects, the B, which is the sigma, is just proportional to the S. And the constant proportionality is 1 over the cosmological constant. We can capture that solution here as a solution of the constraints. Because look, this implies that the object script F, A, B, I, which is, so these are two forms on space-time. And if I pull those two forms on space-time back into any spatial slice, I get these equations that we call script F, which are the constraints of the BF theory. Or equivalently, okay. So let me impose those conditions. I really killed my hand. If I impose those conditions, then that implies script F equals 0, implies C equals the D is equal to 0, because the C and the D are just gotten from script F by multiplying by pi's. Moreover, the Gauss's law constraint is true, because D pi is then just del wedge F with 1 over the cosmological constant equals 0, which is just Gauss's law. So the 9 equations that the script F are 0 imply the 7 equations of our constraints. So they're solutions. Now, they're the simplest solutions with a given cosmological constant if I really want to convince you that this is De Sitter spacetime. I have to do a little work, and I have to look at the equations of motion. So let's look at the equations of motion, and then let's see if we can really find the Sitter spacetime there. So the equations of motion are that A dot is the Poisson bracket of A with C. So So when one goes through the whole Ashtakar constraints, etc., one identifies this C up to on the constraint surface of the other constraints with the Hamiltonian constraint. And so we often, the true equation of motion is gotten by the whole Hamiltonian, which is the Poisson bracket, with all seven of the constraints. But we know that the D and the G just generate, respectively, diffeomorphisms and gauge transformations. So if we want evolution, the evolution is in the C. So let's look at what that involves. We take the Poisson bracket of A with C, say smeared against some N, and the C has terms in pi, in 2 pi's, and terms in 3 pi's. So it's going to give you terms that are going to look like this. Is going to be F A B J pi B K and epsilon I J K. I'm just writing down the kind of terms that we get. And there's also going to be the term which involves lambda epsilon ABC epsilon IJK pi BJ pi CK. And the N, which is the Laplace function, multiplies both of them. So the equation of motion, this is the general equation of motion. It is the effect of A of evolving the three surface forward. And let me note that this is a gauge transformation. It has to be considered a gauge transformation. And it's also an evolution. And when we talked about the Barbara Bertoldi and similar theories, we talked about the fact that when the Hamiltonian is equal to constraints, which are equal to zero, on the constraint surface, you can't tell the difference between gauge transformations that come from redefining time and evolution. And that's what's happening here. This is the result of the gauge field of changing the definition of the time coordinate, or equivalently changing the slicing of the free space. The N is a function. So one can change the three surface locally, that is, one pushes it forward with a lapse, which is an arbitrary function of space and y naught of time as well. Okay. The pi, to compute the Poisson bracket, one has to take the Poisson bracket with the A inside the F. Again, the natural thing to do is to integrate by parts first. And so this looks like the covariant derivative by B, the lapse pi A J pi B K. And this is, I'm not claiming that you should be able to do the calculation this fast, but I've done this calculation many times. So that's what it looks like, where this is the SU2 gauge covariant derivative. So these are the equations of motion generally. So those are the Einstein equations. And they may not seem to you as pretty as R mu nu is a half G mu nu R, but hidden inside the R mu nu is a half G mu nu R are all sorts of inverses of G, derivatives of G, second derivatives of G squared, and all kinds of messes. And this is completely explicit. There's nothing hidden inside any of these equations except that the F everywhere is a derivative of A plus the square of A.
just the standard equation for the annual field strength. So there we have all of the Einstein equations. And to get the connection to, I think the easiest way to get the connection to Sitter spacetime is to write the De Sitter metric and then go back in. So the metric of De Sitter spacetime is ds squared is, so there's a gauge in which it's just minus dt squared plus e to the lambda over 3t dxa dxb delta ab. Is that right? Can somebody verify that that's De Sitter, that's De Sitter spacetime in some particular set of coordinates, which are flat coordinates, where sometimes it's the Hubble constant is written as lambda over 3, or is it square root of lambda over 3? Square root of lambda over 3. All right. What?
It'll be up to a factor there, no matter what.
Okay. So that implies we're interested in the coefficient, that implies we're interested. So the space-time metric looks like the lapse, the shift with lower indices, the shift with lower indices, and the spatial metric, qij. So that implies we're engaged lapse equal to 1, shift is equal to 0, and the spatial metric is e to the square root of lambda over 3 t delta ij. The spatial metric q, and actually I apologize, I'm not writing the right coordinates. These are indices A, B. I apologize. These, in our language, these spatial indices are always A and B. QAB is the frame field EAI, EBJ, delta IJ. So therefore, EAI is equal to e to the 1/2 square root of lambda over 3 t delta ai. And the determinant of q square root is the determinant of delta is 1 and is 3/2 powers over that. So is e to the 3/2. Okay. Am I square yet?
Your EAI equals an exponential and then delta AI?
Yes. So that's a weird, that's nonsense. So delta AI, this is a weird thing because it's diagonal. One of these is a spatial index, and one of these is an SU2 index, but why not?
So now we're just, we are mixing the indices, right?
Yes. Yes, so this is, I'm just making ansatzes. Okay. Okay, so let me suggest, and you can plug in and check, if we want to sum solve the constraints, we're solving f is proportional to pi. Okay. Now, pi so I haven't told you this, so I will tell you now that pi is, which is a vector density, is the determinant of the metric downstairs square root to make a vector density times the frame field with upstairs indices. And if you know the frame field, that is the frame field for vectors. So if you know the frame field for one form, you know the frame field for vectors. You want pi times lambda to be proportional to f. F is derivatives of a's plus the term del a b I twice anti-symmetrize the derivative plus the term epsilon I j k a j a b k. You want this to be equal to lambda times this. Dimensionally, a's are 1 over lengths. They're connections, so they go with derivatives, so they're dimensionally 1 over lengths. So there isn't much that a could be, but square root of the cosmological constant times delta ai times some function of time, because there's no spatial variation in the metric, so therefore you wouldn't expect any spatial variation in the connection. So therefore, you expect something of the form of square root of lambda over 3, just because that's what showed up over there, times t, with some numerical factor here. So the exercise is take this ansatz for A, this ansatz, the related ansatz for the frame field, which gives you pi, you just have to work out the factors of lambda over 3t in the exponential. Plug it into this equation and see if you solve it. If you solve it, you've solved all the constraints by construction. And then plug the result into the equations of motion and check that it's really a solution to the equations of motion. So take these ansatz and check constraint, and the constraints is equivalent to the equations f equals 0, and check the equations of motion. And it's a little bit of work, but I think if you start to plug through it, you'll see it's not terrible. Because look, all the f's collapse, all the pi's are proportional to delta, all the f's are proportional to epsilons, because it's epsilon delta delta. So you're just carrying around some functions of the exponential of time. And you just crank through it, and you'll be able to verify that it's a solution. Okay, so since we're doing cosmology, it's useful to know that the Sitter space-time is really a solution of these equations that we got by many permutations from the Einstein equations. Okay, so questions? I'm setting up as an exercise to check.
Basically, we could put any numerical, any positive numerical factor we wanted, all the dxa, dxb, and it would be Sitter time, but the Sitter space time, just not necessarily related to the cosmological constant in the same way.
Yeah, you mean because you can just put some numerical factor here.
Formally,
right, but the function of time
yes
eventually gets checked by the equations of motion.
Okay. So the question I'm having is, will this only give it that, that is, there's only one dissider spacetime that will work? Specifically the one with cosmological constant
well,
in right form?
Look, you're allowed to redefine the spatial derivatives. This is dissider spacetime with the spatially flat metric.
I'm saying I could replace it with 5t, and technically it's, or 5t squared, say.
Well, if you rescale time, you will be rescaling the lapse.
Okay.
So I picked a lapse equals one version. So you see, if you want to rescale the function of time up here, you have to mess with this. And you'll see that you do. So it's not as free as you think it is. It actually is tight. It goes through and you check the whole dissider metric. Okay. So while we're on dissider space time, let me provide just a little bit of insight. So let's think about the Hamilton-Jacobi method and solving the equations of motion and the constraint equations. Oops, and I guess have I just wiped out C or C is somewhere? I would like to keep.
There's C all the way over here.
Well, that's its form in terms of script F. Anyway, it's in everybody's notes. I'll just bring it back to the page. The idea of solving equations of motion with the Hamilton-Jacobi function is the following. You have here a phase space, gamma. Gamma gives you the coordinates q's and p's. And you write down a function on configuration space of the q's, and you make an ansatz that pa is the derivative with respect to QA of this function, and you plug this in typically to the Hamiltonian. Or if you have constraints, the constraints are functions of P's and Q's equals zero, and so now they're functions of derivative of S and Q's, and you try to solve those and find Hamilton-Jacobi functions S. So I hope everybody has had that at some point in classical mechanics, Hamilton-Jacobi function. What's good about them is that semi-classical wave functions, and I haven't introduced quantization yet, this is kind of a preview, semi-classical wave functions are typically of the form of psi of q is sometimes some determinant one has to worry about, e to the I some Hamilton-Jacobi function of q. And then that solves to leading order in h-bar the quadratic version of the constraint equations or the Hamiltonian equations of motion. Okay, so is everybody comfortable? You've seen that somewhere, used somewhere. So I just want to illustrate that technique with this class of solutions. So the class of solutions that we're interested in are the ones where pi ai is equal to 1 over the cosmological constant times epsilon abc fbc I, and there's sometimes a 2 there, if one does it right. So we're interested in those solutions. So we're interested in finding a function S
of the connections on this three-manifold such that its functional derivative by the connection is proportional to the field strength. So in other words, we seek a function S such that delta S, I'm just rewriting the equation, delta AI is 1 over 2 lambda epsilon ABC FBCI. And if we can find such a function, then we will have found all the solutions where script F is equal to 0, which are therefore solutions of the constraints. And what I've shown is that among these solutions are De Sitter spacetime. So this is an interesting set of solutions. And I'm being cavalier about reality, the fields being real. I'm being cavalier about factors of I, and so forth, which I'm going to come back later and very meticulously fix. So forgive me for the cavalierness. Okay. So we're interested in a function whose derivative, it's a function of a connection, an SU2 connection on a three-manifold, whose derivative is the Yang-Mills field strength of that connection. Does anybody know if there exists any such function? Well, that is the property of a function that mathematicians introduced, which is a beautiful function. It's called the Church-Simons invariant of the function. So I'll call it SCS for Church-Simons. And it is of the form of A wedge DA, writing it down in form language, plus, and I always forget whether it's 1 or 2/3, but the way to do it is to check it by its properties, AI wedge AB, AJ wedge AK. And so that is called the Church-Simon invariant of the connection on a three-manifold, and it's particularly a property of three-manifolds. And this is the defining, if you like, the defining property of the Church-Simons invariant. Okay, questions? Now let me note that this is not the integral of A wedge F. It's not equal to that. And let me note that this object here, that's the integral of, which is sometimes called the Church-Simons free form, at a point is not gauge invariant. So under gauge transformations, this object is not written in a way that looks gauge invariant. That is under delta A, which is the Poisson bracket of A, say, with G of lambda, which we know is the covariant derivative, and we call this little lambda. Then delta of y under that transformation, let's call it delta lambda of y, is a total derivative of something. Again, I'm not going to do this calculation for you, but this is something you can check. Therefore, delta lambda of the integral of y on a compact manifold is 0.
There's one question.
Yes.
Is that statement the first statement in the bottom line? Is that valid only locally or globally? So does the bracket, is that something globally defined or only locally?
So I think what you're referring to is that this is an infinitesimal gauge transformation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I'm discussing here, this is just true for an infinitesimal gauge transformation. And since you raised it, we can, let's see, let me put it here. There is an interesting and very important property under what are called large gauge transformations. So I have here to make a definition. So let me take the case that sigma is the three sphere. And let me use the fact that the group SU2 is also a three sphere. It's a three parameter group. And if you study its topology, you can show that it is a three sphere. And let me consider a large gauge transformation. Which we discussed before. So this is where I have a function V on space, which lives in the group SU2. And under this gauge transformation, the covariant derivative, del A, goes to V inverse times the covariant derivative times V, which gives a transformation law for the A's that you can work out. Now, such a gauge transformation gives me an SU2. I'm on the three sphere is my space. Let's assume that this room is sitting inside of a three sphere. For every point in space, I'm giving you a point on another three sphere, which is an element of SU2. So a gauge transformation is a mapping from the three sphere to the three sphere. And just like a mapping from a circle, there's a winding number. And it has a more precise definition, but since I'm just answering a question, maybe, and I wasn't prepared to give it, let me just say there's an integer W, which is a winding number which characterizes a map from a three sphere to a three sphere, just like if I make a map from a circle to a circle, I can, when I start, this point goes to this point, and as I go around the circle, I can go around here some number of times, which is the winding number. Okay, so the property that you're alluding to, which is a beautiful property, is that the integral of the Chern-Simons invariant under such a transformation does not go to itself. It goes to itself. That's what it would do if it really were a gauge invariant. So it goes to itself under small gauge transformations. Small gauge transformations are winding number zero. That is in the homotopy class of the identity. So I can continuously deform to the identity. But there is a term which I believe this is from memory, but somebody will know it, is 8 pi squared times the winding number of the gauge transformation. Is it 8 pi squared? I think it's 8 pi squared. Certainly, there was a period when I knew that, and I, you know, ate, slept, and dreamed that 8 pi squared, but that's a long time ago. So this is a beautiful property. And it means that the Chern-Simons invariant
is not completely invariant. It's invariant under DP morphisms because it's a natural object made from three forms. It's invariant under small gauge transformations. But under large gauge transformations, it behaves in a way which mirrors which measures the winding number of the topology of the gauge transformation. So this is a very important and beautiful property of the transcendent domain. Now let me note, since you brought it up, I'm not going to dwell on it because I didn't prepare it, but it's something that we could go back to. What that means is that if this is the space of connections on S3, and I consider the function S transignment. So these are the level surfaces of S transignment. So I start with S transignment equals 0, S transignment equals 1, etc. And when I get to S transignment, so this is S transignment equals 0, when I get to S transignment is a pi squared, I can make a large gauge transformation go back to this surface where the transignment invariant is 0. See that? It means that by making a large gauge transformation, I can jump from any surface, level surface of the value of this function, to the surface time plus 8 pi squared, plus twice 8 pi squared, plus 3 8 pi squared, and so forth. So it means that this, that if I consider the space, if I consider this gauge transformations to be gauge transformations, it means this is really a cylinder times some other space. It means that any surface and the surface 8 pi squared larger has to be identified. So there's really a cylinder. Okay. Now, strictly speaking, I've been ignoring complex numbers and the fact that these objects are complex. And we'll talk about that next time. But strictly speaking, this is true for the Euclidean case, and because in the Euclidean case, the A's are all real. And there aren't, everything is real functions. So this is strictly true for the Euclidean case. And the Euclidean case is the case where I change the sign of the metric, so it's a positive Euclidean metric. So that's like going to imaginary time. That's like taking the time chord into imaginary time. Okay. Now, there's a famous result of quantum mechanics called the KMS, Komogorov, Martin, and Schwinger, that if I do quantum mechanics of a system which is heated to a temperature T, then all the endpoint functions, all the observables, are periodic in imaginary time. So all observables are periodic in imaginary time with a period beta related, I guess, related to, is it t or 1 over t? No, as t goes to 0, the period should go to infinity. 1 over kt. And so from this behavior of this function on the configuration space, you can conclude that if you go to imaginary time, so everything I've said is strictly true, so all the functions are real, okay, any observable on this configuration space is going to be periodic. And it's going to be periodic. You have to work back through all the constants to get what the period is. And when you do that, you come to the conclusion that any observable in de Sitter spacetime, any quantum mechanical observable, is thermal, is hot. That is, there's an intrinsic temperature to de Sitter spacetime. And that is, in fact, the temperature that has been computed. You get precisely the temperature that Gibbons, Hawking, and Perry computed in the 1970s using straightforward methods of thermal quantum field theory and quantum field theory in closed spacetime. Which I don't, again, I didn't prepare this, so I don't remember what that temperature is. But this is a very quick and easy way to show and get insight into the fact that quantum mechanics in de Sitter spacetime is thermal. So I probably, you provoked me to go more than I wanted to about that, but that's all kind of warm up. Okay, let me ask for questions, then I have 10 minutes, and I will start to talk about quantum mechanics. Okay, all right, we'll start briefly to talk about quantum mechanics. So Dirac, and I hope that everybody has gotten this little book of Dirac. Dirac faced the problem of how to quantize a quantum mechanical system, a classical system with first class constraints. And he made a proposal, an incomplete proposal, and in the remaining time I just want to explain what that proposal was. Because it's the basis of most work that's done in quantum cosmology, as well as quantum gauge theories and so forth. We may want to, very much want to come back and criticize and critique this proposal for cases like general relativity of cosmology, but this is the most influential proposal on the subject. So remember that we start off, we have some phase space of Q's and P's. And then we have some constraints, let me call them C alpha, which are functions of Q's and P's, which are zero. And I'm just going to assume that they're first class for the moment. And by first class, I mean not business class. I'm going to come back and discuss the business class case, which we see as the case for general relativity. Well, so how are you going to turn this into quantum mechanics? One thing that you could do is you could solve the constraints, which means find some other coordinates, Q star and P star, just on the constraint surface. So you only consider the constraint surface, C alpha equals zero. You find some Poisson brackets of Q star and P star. You find some algebra of observables on the constraint surface. You compute their algebra. Okay. And then a quantization is a representation. So then a quantization is some Hilbert space, which means a complex vector space with an inner product in Hilbert space. And I'm going to call this H star, okay, which carries a representation of, and I didn't really give this a name, but let me call A star the algebra of observables. On the constraint surface. Okay, so this is not Dirac's proposal. This is solve and then quantize. Okay. Well, solve them and quantize is very convenient when the constraints are linear in the momenta. So when all the constraints have the form of some function of q times terms linear in the momenta, and that's all you're dealing with, you can do generally solve and then quantize. Although when these are nonlinear functions, so for example, for Maxwell theory, it's trivial, you can do solve and then quantize. Solve means represent the Maxwell equations in terms of explicitly two components, two polarizations of electromagnetic waves. And then you can quantize those, the harmonic oscillators of those spin one massless degrees of freedom. Even for Yang-Mills theory, in principle, you can do it, but it's hard. And because even though the Gauss's law are linear in the momenta, they're nonlinear functions because of the covariant derivatives. For cases where the constraints are quadratic in the momenta times functions of the q's, there's no good examples where solve and quantize has worked completely, and these include general relativity, and these include string theory. Now, string theory is a special case, and maybe I can talk about it in detail if people want in some class. In string theory, there is a gauge in which we haven't talked about string theory at all, but there are constraints, because string theory has the gauge invariance of diffeomorphisms on a two-dimensional surface, which is the world sheet of the string. And there is a gauge in which the resulting constraints are linear. And because of that, it is possible to define string theory by quantization in that linear gauge, and then by fixing that linear gauge and then quantizing. That, however, is not, there are issues about the relationship of that quantization to other quantizations, which is a whole can of worms I don't want to touch. Okay, but what is called generically string theory is fix a gauge and then the constraints linearize, and then you solve them, and then you quantize. In general relativity, nobody knows how to do this. Nobody knows how to solve, find observables of just the solutions, of just the constraint surface, find an algebra of them, and then quantize. If we could do that, that many people, I'm sure, feel would be the preferred way. What Dirac proposed was an alternative to that, assuming that that was too hard to do. And so let me tell you what Dirac's proposal was, and then we'll come back and try to implement it. Dirac's proposal, so this is method two, proposed by Dirac, is first quantize the whole phase space. So there's some Poisson bracket on the whole phase space gamma of the Q's and P's. And to spell it out, you want to find an algebra of functions on the whole phase space which closes. So find some complete functions f of q and p, f I of q and p on the whole phase space. Complete means that they coordinatize the whole phase space, so if you know their values, you know what point you are in the phase space. And you want them to be closed, which means that the algebra of them is proportional to themselves. And then two, you find a Hilbert space. So let me call this algebra A K for kinematical. You find, you want to find a Hilbert space which carries a representation of A kinematical. And let me say precisely what that means. That means that there are operators A hat and the commutator of two algebras is H bar times the operator connected to the Poisson bracket. Sorry, I called it F. Plus possibly terms of higher order in H bar. And you also want that F is real on the phase space. It implies that the operator that represents F is Hermitian. And that's why it's important. This is not just a linear vector space. This is a Hilbert space, and the Hilbert space comes with an inner product. And one wants to realize the condition that real observables in this algebra are represented by Hermitian operators. And then that's what's called, let me put a K here, that's what's called the kinematical Hilbert space. Because we have not expressed the dynamics yet. The dynamics is in the constraints because these are systems whose Hamiltonian includes or are nothing but constraints. Yes.
What are the order of H bar square terms?
Trouble. You'd prefer it if they weren't there, but sometimes they are there. It's nicer if there aren't any. It's nicer if you could find an algebra which is complete where there aren't any. Now, let me mention that functions of interest, like the constraints and like the Hamiltonian, may not be contained in this algebra of complete functions. The functions of interest, like the constraints of the Hamiltonian, may have to be written as functions of these, which are nonlinear, or they may have to be written even as limits of products in a field theory. Typically, you're going to have to deal with regularization and limits and so forth. Okay. And so the third step, okay, is express the constraints and the Hamiltonian, okay, as limits. I'm spelling out everything that Dirac did not spell out, his limits of functions of the FI. Okay? Which means that we're going to be able to construct, in some cases, for every constraint an operator, which may be, which means we. So this is, the operator is some limits of products of the fundamental operators fi. Okay. So Dirac didn't mention this, but folks, this is real life. Okay. If the constraints were linear functions, if the Hamiltonian was just quadratic, we could skip all this. Okay, so this is the case where in the nice coordinates by which we know the phase space, the constraints in the Hamiltonian are not linear or quadratic functions. And there's a limited success in finding these objects. That is, finding a nice complete algebra of functions such that they have a representation, such that real functions are represented by Hermitian operators. That's already asking a lot. And in cases of interest, you do not get that the constraints of the Hamiltonian are just in this list of functions that go direct. In other words, this tells you, so there's a basic theorem about quantization, that there's no prescription that given any function on the phase space gives you an operator. You get a sub-algebra of functions on the phase space, which goes to a nice algebra of operators. That's the way quantization works. And then what do you do with the other functions on the phase space? Well, you fake it as best you can. And that's why there are operator ordering issues, and that's why there's regularization issues, and that's why there's denormalization issues. This is real life. Okay? So then, step four is you apply the constraints to whatever success they're defined from this step. You have to find some operators, maybe by having to take limits, to perform a normalization, whatever. You look for states in the Hilbert space that you have, so where these states live in the kinematical Hilbert space. And you look then for states, you don't try to solve the equations that the operators, which represent the constraints, are equal to zero. Because they're not equal to zero, they're operators. They're not functions that you can look for surfaces when they're equal to zero, they're operators. So it's not meaningful to set them equal to zero as operators. They have an algebra, for example. Okay, so if you just set them equal to, if you thought you could set them equal to zero, all their products commutators would be zero, and you wouldn't be doing quantum mechanics. So what you do is you look to find a set of states which are annihilated by the constraints, and you hope that these states live in a Hilbert space that we call the physical Hilbert space, and we believe that that should be, in some sense, which I'm going to say something about, and then that will be the last thing I say, a subspace of the kinematical Hilbert space. This is what Dirac said, anyway. And then you found states on which the constraints don't generate any changes. The constraint acting on a state is zero. And if you think of the constraint as a generator of gauge transformations, this suggests that these are states which are gauge invariant, because you act on them with an operator which is a quantization of a generator of gauge transformations, and you get zero. So you think that these should be the gauge invariant states. And you collect them together in a subspace of states you call the Hilbert space. Anyway, that's what Dirac calls it. Again, there's a little bit of a reality check. It's in all the interesting cases, the states, typical states which are annihilated by the constraints, are not actually proper states. They typically, first of all, often live in a dual space of the Hilbert space, and they're often, even in that context, not normalizable. So they're only states in quotes. They're objects you can write in the functional language of states, but they typically are not normalizable in the inner product of that by which you define this algebra of operators that represent the classical theory. So then there's a last step that Dirac did not mention, which is find an inner product that makes some subset of H, some subspace of these H physical a Hilbert space. And again, a last point such that real observables by this whole process map to the Hermitian operators. So that's, with the fine print filled in, what Dirac told us to do. And I'll stop there. Questions?
For electromagnetism, do method 1, 2 agree?
For electromagnetism, there are certainly versions of 1 and 2 that agree. Yes.
Do you have references the way it's done? I've never seen it done.
Did what?
I've never seen either method 1 or 2 being done for electromagnetism.
Would it be useful for you to, for me to do that? Yeah, I can do that. I'm not going to do it now, but I can do that.
Yeah, it'd be useful.
I can even do a free angles here. Okay, so let me make some illustrations. It does work with standard gauge theories well enough that real physics is derived from this. Okay. Other questions? So this was Dirac's proposal to make a quantum theory of gravity. And roughly speaking, in the old ABM variables, this program was never realized. Essentially, even step 2 was never really realized in an honest fashion. And certainly step 3, that is expressing the constraints as honest operators on some space of states, was never realized. In the formalism that follows from the Ashtakar formulation and similar formulations, one gets to the neighborhood of 5. And then it gets controversial. And part of what I want to do in the next lectures is start to make the case that the difficulties that emerge here, so one gets almost all the way using the Ashtakar kind of formulation, but one does not get all the way cleanly so far as we know. And the case that I want to make is that is because of the issue of time. That is that in the Dirac description, there are some assumptions and hypotheses about the nature of time and the way that the reparametrization invariance or the diffeomorphism invariance relating to the meaning of time is coded in. There are assumptions made about that in the Dirac procedure, and my working hypothesis is that the fact that the Dirac procedure does not work cleanly all the way, at least so far, some brilliant person may push it the last step. But my hypothesis is that this is because of unresolved issues about the nature of time and assumptions that Dirac implicitly is making, which most likely are not true. So that's where we're going. That's why we've done all this preparation. And more questions.
Is there any reason to expect that method 1 and 2 agree?
No. And there are models that are explicitly constructed of ordinary finite dimensional quantum mechanical systems where you can explicitly show that sometimes 1 and 2 agree and sometimes they don't agree. And it's not difficult to invent counterexamples to 1 and 2 agree. Okay, questions? Any questions if anybody's still there out of Western? Okay. let's, if there are no more questions, let's close and see you all next week.